Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Gill.
And this is the podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, normally I start by asking you what you've been reading, but I should think we should start by talking about the fact that both of us are in a massive reading slump and have really been struggling to read so far. So it's like we're recording this at nearly the end of April. We're not sure when we're going to put it out yet because we're reading that slowly. I have read fewer books since January than I normally read in a month, basically, is where
I'm not that far behind. I think I've read, I looked earlier, I think I've read about 25 books, which is still a lot by lots of people's standards. So I'm not, you know, knocking it, but it's definitely a lot less. You know, normally it's sort of 12, 15 a month. And I've done a lot less. I've only read two books so far this month, and we're on the 22nd of April. So it's not so much reading books at the right time as not reading books at the moment, which is great. I think this year has so far just been really hard. And the thing that has taken the hit for me has been my reading concentration. I mean, obviously, I have to read for work. That's part of my job. And I can do that because it's for my job, so I can sort of compartmentalize it and do it. Mm. Although I'm not reading as fast as I normally do, even for work stuff. But if, for me, like for stuff outside of work, I'm really struggling. And I think for me, I mean, I had COVID at the start of the year. It hit me a lot harder this time than when I had COVID the first time. You know, there's been lots of other various stressful things going on around me and in my life and proximate to me and all that sort of stuff. And I think the thing that's just taken the hit has been my concentration, because I mean, I've just ended up playing a lot of nonsense games on my phone.
I'm going to be sanctimonious now and say, like, I feel like I've dealt with it a little bit more healthily than that, in that I've spent a lot more time walking and just gone, oh, I need to be outside. And it's too cold to sit outside and read. So I'm out walking. But yeah, I've had a shocker of a start to the year. So what's happened? So the PhD that I was talking about, we weren't going to record because I needed to finish my PhD, is not finished. And at one point it looked like I wasn't going to be able to finish it for reasons mostly outside my control. And now I am on a break in study because I am ill, although not as ill as I was. So I had to have loads of tests, possibly TMI, but some people will chime with this. So it turned out that basically I'm perimenopausal, so I'm now on HRT, which is doing wonders. In fact, my skin is fucking amazing, I have to say. I mean, it's out with other things as well, but I have excellent skin at the minute, which is a bonus.
We're taking all the positives we can get at this point.
Yes. And then my relationship ended. And now I found out my job's changing as well, in a way that means that I basically have got no work for half of the year. So, yeah, quite a lot going on. Not really fussed about reading. Which is excellent when you do a books podcast and you also read for work. I have to say, I am doing an event that will have passed by the time we put this out, but I am doing an event next week, which I'm very much looking forward to. And I have read the book and I am very excited about it.
Good.
Yes, so it's a good job. I can only do things about books that are really good.
Only good books, mediocre
books around here.
What else? I got diagnosed with ADHD. I've nothing if not on trend. I and most of the population of women in their 40s, apparently, have been diagnosed recently. So there's also something with that, there's been a process of kind of going, how did I not notice before? Because once you know, it gets pointed out to you and you start reading about all the things that could be ADHD symptoms, you kind of go, these are all separate things that I've been sort of beating myself up about for 40 years, you know, that I'm forgetful and careless, and I forget things that happen. I forget everyone's birthday. I'm a terrible proofreader, constant typos, I can't stay still, I fidget all the time. My brain, I always call my I call the my brain the Greek chorus. It's just sort of constant chatter going on in there, and you know, just lots and lots of stuff that I have sort of just really disliked about myself my whole life and thought of as failings. And someone has finally, you know, gone, actually, your brain works a bit differently. And you go, oh, I didn't have to spend all this time hating myself. That's fascinating. So I think that's also been a big part of it for me. I mean, so weirdly, and we've laughed about this before, and I've laughed about this my whole life, but actually suddenly it's gone, oh, so a lot of people with ADHD or some people with ADHD struggle to read because of the concentration or concentrating for long periods of time. I clearly, apart from this year, have had no issue with that. But what I can't do is watch films because I think they're too long. I find all films to be too long. I can watch 5 episodes back to back of a box set that would be twice the length of a film. But there's something about sitting down to watch a film where I just go, oh, it's too long. I've got 2 hours. No, why would I do that? and it's this thing I've laughed at about myself forever. Like, I don't watch films. But there you go. That's why.
There we go.
That's my revelation of the year.
Well, I'm glad you like yourself a bit more now.
I'm working on it. Let's not get too far ahead of ourselves.
So other than that, we have actually read some books. So tell us about one you've read, Kirsty, that you've enjoyed recently.
Just to cheer us all up, I'm going to talk about a book about grief. So an incredible book that I read is A Heart That Works by Rob Delaney, which came out last year from Coronet. Now, lots of people will know Rob Delaney from... Well, first of all, I think he came to prominence on Twitter. He was sort of one of the original, like the OG people that got famous for being funny on Twitter.
Jump in here. Rob Delaney was a comedian. I went to see him do his comedy acts like way before he was famous on Twitter, my friend.
I know, but that's how he's come to like main public prominence. I'd never heard of him before Twitter.
Just let me be a wanker for a second.
Okay. Have you finished being a wanker?
Probably not.
We shall continue.
it's just
yeah, so many people apart from Naomi first heard of Rob Delaney through Twitter. And then, of course, he did Catastrophe with Sharon Horgan, which I've not watched, obviously. And he's just generally known for being very funny. But what he is also something that people know about him now is that he had a little boy called Henry, who died of cancer before he was 3, which is just one of those horrific tragedies that you can't even begin to contemplate if you have not been there yourself. And this book is about that. This book is about Henry, but it is about being the parent to a very sick child. It's about being a parent to a child who's got a terminal diagnosis. It's about being a parent to a dead child, but living children at the same time. It is about grief. It is about life. It is about the NHS and how we must protect it. It's just about how to carry on after something that horrific has happened to you. And the thing about it is, it's, I mean, there are bits that are, you know, just heart-wrenchingly sad, but it's also a very funny book. He's a very funny man, and he manages to, I don't think there's anything quite like the death of a child that in the wrong hands, it would become incredibly sort of maudlin and, you know, how do you write about something that tragic? But he does it in such a way that is incredibly confronting and, but all the better for that. So I'm going to read a bit, and I'm going to try and read this bit without crying. I may or may not be successful, but let's all see, shall we? This is from very near the beginning of the book. And this is it's quite visceral in a way. So if you don't feel that you are in a place to listen to that, I would maybe skip ahead a few minutes. It is quite astonishing. So it's not infrequently, I find myself wanting to ask people I know and like to imagine a specific child of theirs dead in their arms. If you have more than one child, it is critical for you to pick one for this exercise. If you're reading this and you have a child, do it now. Imagine them in your arms, tubes coming out of various holes, some of which are natural, some of which were made with a scalpel. There's mess coming out of some of the tubes. There are smells. The temperature of your child's body is dropping. No breath, none of the wriggling that seems to be the main activity of kids, no heartbeat. Even just that, imagine searching for your child's heartbeat and you can't find one. Their heart will never beat again. It's not a nightmare you can wake from. Defibrillation won't work. It won't beat because your child is dead. After a bit, someone will put them in a refrigerated drawer like you do with celery that turns white and soft when you forget about it. Did you ever make funny horns on their head with shampoo while they're in the bathtub? You will never do that again. Did they ask for help with their shoelaces and their homework? Did you comfort them after a skinned knee? That will never happen again. It's unlikely I'll ever ask anyone to do that face to face. Honestly, the idea makes me laugh. Where would we do it? A kitchen, probably. Do I make them tea first? But the point is, I feel the urge. That is one thing grief does to me. It makes me want to make you understand. It makes me want you to understand. I want you to understand. But you statistically cannot. You forget that my son died, and then you remember, and then you forget again. I don't forget. I don't hanker for much about Victorian times, but the idea of wearing all black following the death of someone you love makes a lot of sense to me. For a while anyway, I'd have liked you to know, even from across the street or through the telescope, that I am grieving. And he covers so much about the sort of visceral details of his illness, of Henry's illness, but also he writes a lot about the people that he meets. He writes about the carers that he had in the hospitals he was in. He writes about the NHS. Obviously, he's American who moved to the UK in his 30s. And I think his first two children were born in the US, and then he had children in the UK. And just the first time you go to the doctors when you come to the UK, and him just expecting to ask to be paid to pay and being walked out without being charged, you know, that sort of thing, about how we have to, you know, yes, the NHS is imperfect and it is underfunded and there are problems, but dear God, it is better than the alternative. He talks about the fact that his family was going through, you know, over and above this horrific thing that happened. He lost his brother-in-law at roughly the same time. And then just after Henry died, his dad was diagnosed with cancer, and he found himself just going, well, yes, you're in your 70s. I'm not going to feel the same way about this that I did about my son. You know, that sort of, you're supposed to get ill now. But also the way that him and his wife sort of tried to process some of their grief. And that was for them watching horror films. Like, he talks about watching Cloverfield Lane. Is it Cloverfield Lane? I don't know. Don't watch films, as we covered. Just watching, you know, horrific horror films and laughing, and this being this catharsis for them, and kind of wanting to thank Ari Aster for helping him and his wife through the most unimaginable thing that's happened to them. It's a great book. I cried so many times reading it, I can't even tell you. But it is a book that, though I read it quite a while ago now, I still think about. And it's brilliant, although it's a lot. It may not be for everyone, but is, if you do feel in a place to read it, then I strongly recommend it.
I bought it when it came out, and it has sat on my shelf since. And I said to you before we started recording, it might leave my flat never having been opened, because I don't have to face it. Partly because I've got two people like close to me that both lost children in very different circumstances, but still, just that bit that you read, I mean, it is unimaginable. And like reading that from someone else's perspective, yeah, it's a lot. Yeah,
it's a lot. But I think it is and he does do it in a confrontational way. But I think I sort of loved that, because you can see, and I've seen in interviews, you know, there are loads of clips of him being interviewed about the book. And actually what he wants is people to be sad. It's a really sad thing. He wants people to have a reaction. He wants people to go, God, this is just fucking awful. Like, your child died. This is awful. And he's like, this is, you know, he doesn't want people going, oh, I don't really know what to say. He's like, tell me it's terrible, you know. So anyway, if I do anything else, I'm going to start crying. So I'm just going to casually just wipe away a tear and carry on. What have you been reading?
So I actually read this on holiday. So the one nice thing I did earlier this year was I went to Wales for a week in February, if you can call that a nice thing to do. and I stayed in a cottage that was right on the edge of the Cardigan Bay. So right, like literally the sea was the bottom of the back garden. And I read Sea Bean, A Beachcomber's Search for a Magical Charm by Sally Hubbard, which is a debut. It's nonfiction. It's published by Hutchinson Hyman. It's already out. It is about Sally Hubbard and her family. So her family at the time were her husband and her small son, as in like he was little, not as in he's just very small. Moving to Shetland, so her they had to move for her husband's job. He does something on the oil rigs that I can't quite remember, because I sort of went, yeah, oil rigs, no, not interested. So that bit, and she doesn't talk that much about what he does actually. It's more about her. So she gives up this academic job to be there. She ends up with a chronic illness, so she has other pregnancies. So there's a bit of a sort of content note here that she has carriages. She does eventually have a daughter as well, but those pregnancies trigger a form of arthritis that is normally only present in women who've had many more pregnancies than that. So obviously it means that she's got to slow down, because some days she just can't do the things that she has been used to doing. So one of the things that she starts to do when she gets to Shetland is obviously she spends quite a lot of time on the beach. She starts beach combing, looking for things that are washed up on the beach. So there's all sorts of interesting things, and there's different chapters about things like sea glass, because that's a nice thing to collect with kids, but also it's framed by this sea bean, because the sea beans come from the northeast Atlantic, so that's quite a sort of unusual thing to wash up. So the book's framed by a search for this sea bean, although there are other more interesting things. I learned about how windy it is on Shetland and how terrified they were the first time there was a storm. Although I quite fancy, because I love the sea, so I sort of quite fancied the idea of being somewhere like on a remote, fairly remote island. I hadn't realised, I don't think, quite how far Shetland actually is. North,
it's a long way. It's like it's like 6 hours past Scotland. Just long way up.
Yeah, like possibly closer to Norway than it is to Scotland.
Totally, totally. There's loads of, I think, Norwegian names and sort of Scandinavian names are pretty, you know, comparatively common.
So yeah, and then she obviously she pays attention to the wildlife, which is really interesting, and the different birds they get in Shetland. There's a point where, because she's volunteered and she started so tracking, so keeping a record of some of the birds that come and how many arrive, because the bird populations, as we know, are dying out. So they're taking like surveys, and because she's got involved with that, she goes on a course where she learns to dissect birds, and it's like it is horrible, this bit. So I was on holiday with my now ex-boyfriend and was reading bits out to him, and one of the bits that I read him was about when she's dissecting these birds. I can't remember specifically which birds, but they've washed up and they're obviously malnourished, so they're trying to find out why they're malnourished. And when they cut them open, their stomachs have got plastic in, and it's the plastic making them feel full, and therefore they're not eating. So basically we're killing the birds by putting plastic crap in water. There's some of the bits that obviously are less end of the world ish than that. There's a bit where a whale turns up, which is during COVID, and everybody goes for a nosy, and they think the police are gonna bollock them, but the police come for a look as well. There's some really good bits. Some of my favorite bits were about sending messages in bottles, and how many wash up. They get lots from Norway, because they're near, and lots of theirs wash up in Norway, which leads to her becoming friends with someone in Norway, and she goes over to see him, which is really nice. I also laughed at some of the things that she found in the bottle. So there's one, I couldn't find the exact bit when I was looking for it earlier, but there's one where she picks one up and it's somebody who's on a weekend away with some friends, and she basically says that she hates them all. And then there's this one. Oh, there's also one where I think it's a friend finds one that's it's the ashes of a postman who had like traveled loads, and his son had put his ashes into the bottle, and so they get in touch with him because it's got his details in, and they drop it back into the sea later on so he can travel further, which I thought was cute.
Yeah.
This bit makes me laugh, where it says, meanwhile, a friend tells me that her niece once found a bottle containing a note that simply read, "You nosy cunt." So I very much enjoyed that bit. But yeah, as a whole, I found it a really interesting book. Like, I learned things that I didn't know. Yeah, and it was her stories, part of it, but not massively intrusive. And obviously, you know, if you're reading that as someone with a chronic illness, and I mean, I haven't got a chronic illness. I'm fucking perimenopausal, but I was quite ill on holiday from like having a multitude of symptoms that were making me feel shit. So I had some sympathy with that sort of like, there were things that I just couldn't do that my body did not want to do anymore. I couldn't open jars. Like, it was that bad that I couldn't open things. So I like, yeah, I think I read it at sort of the right time as well for me to like feel quite empathetic towards somebody who's struggling with the things they couldn't do. There is also, this is very, I don't know, what's the word I want? I don't know. I was going to say vain, shallow, very shallow of me, but it's very aesthetically pleasing as well. There are some beautiful lino cut prints that illustrate each of the chapters. So I was lucky enough, because I got proof that I got sent some postcards with someone that are gorgeous and they're going on my wall. So
I love lino cuts.
Yes. So yeah, it was a really interesting book, both sad and funny, I thought.
That sounds really good. Well, several things. I really want to go to Shetland. I've never been to Shetland and I'd really like to. I have always been fascinated by messages and bottles. That idea of sort of sending a message out and a stranger finding it, that's something I've sort of always had in my imagination. And I remember when I was at primary school, we were trying to do that thing of, you know, you like attach a message to a balloon and you send the balloon off and you see if it comes down somewhere. And I'd been so looking forward to this, because it's the same thing, right? It's like sending that message out into the great beyond. Unfortunately, we were children, but none of our teachers had quite done the maths on is you're meant to use helium balloons and not just blow up balloons, because we kept trying to throw them in the air and they kept falling down. And honestly, I've never been so gutted in my life.
Oh, dear.
Anyway. Yeah, that sounds great. I'd like to read that.
There we go.
So let us kick off then series 6, 5. I've lost count. What number are we on?
I think it's 6.
It is, because we did 3 the first year and 2 the second, didn't we?
Yeah.
Series 6 of Late to It, books we continue to be late to. We are still late to books and getting later, as we have discussed. So the two books we're talking about this week are This One Sky Day by Leonie Ross, which was published by Faber in 2021, came out paperback in 22, and 100 Boyfriends by Brontez Purnell, Cypher Press 2021. I feel like there's quite a lot to talk about, particularly with the Leonie Ross. It wasn't quite what I was expecting, but we will get into that. What the book is generally about is there is an island called Popeshow, which is, and in fact in America I think the novel's called Popeshow. But it is it's never expressly stated that it's in the Caribbean, but certainly has a Caribbean feel to it. And everyone on the island has what they call a cause, or a sort of magical power. One of our main characters, Xavier, is the Mecenas, which is that he can impart incredible flavor into food with his hands, you know, like salt comes out of his hands or spices or something like that. And he has the task of cooking one extraordinary meal for every person on the island at some point in their life. We have a niece who has healing powers. We have Romanza, who can detect lies. And then there's lots of other people that you, they're the kind of main characters. And then there are other characters that have different cores, you know, of all different types. And what this book is one day in the life of this island where, well, something quite extraordinary happens. And that is that all the women on their island, their vulvas fall off, which is not an average day. But they all fall off, and some of them roll away. One gets dropped in a river, fair careless. Others get different ones back. But this is the sort of central events of this one particular day that thing happens. And there's various, so we have other things. There's another character called Santine who's about to get married. We have Xavier thinking about his late wife. We have Romanza, who is the brother of Santine, who has been sort of cast out from his family for being queer. And we have this extraordinary group of sex workers who are sort of some of the best characters in it. I sort of don't know where to go from that, because it's like one day on this island and all the vulvas fall off.
Well, the blurb for it talks about how it's two star-crossed lovers that are supposed to be coming back together. And I felt that that was massively misleading.
I don't feel like that was the main thread of the book. That is a thing that happens.
Mm.
Xavier and Anise, who sort of were the ones that got away from each other early in their life, but turned out a niece was engaged to someone else, and Xavier went on to marry someone else as well. And, you know, they've obviously long held a candle for each other, but I didn't feel like that was the plot of the book.
Now, Kirsty.
Hello.
If you can tell me the plot of the book, I'll give you my bank account.
Well, there isn't really a plot of the book. It's a day in the life of this island and everyone's vulvas fall off.
I mean, that's not the only thing that's happened. I don't even think that's the most interesting thing that happens in the book by some way.
No, but it's the most memorable, I would.
Well, it could.
This will be the book where all the vulvas fall, you know, in my memory, like in a year's time or 2 years' time, what happened in this one sky day, the vulvas fell off.
I think that's also the bit that sort of spans the most number of pages probably as well. Like it just seems to keep going. I thought it was going to be a thing
just
that
keep
happen,
on rolling down the road.
Yeah. Yeah, that does go on for quite some time, the whole like vulva palaver. Well, it is a palaver.
It is a palaver. It's a right kerfuffle.
I was trying to work out why it had happened. But there seems to be some suggestion that it's the island that's done it to cause mischief or some such.
It is a mischief.
Yes. And also, it does lead to some of the other events. So, Santine's in trouble, basically, because of it. Because she was having oral sex before she got married with her husband-to-be when hers fell off and he thought he'd done it.
At least it was her husband-to-be, I suppose. Well, yes. And then like, he
not please mummy and daddy.
No, but he was very careless, and I mean I can't remember exactly why he was keeping it, but he then dropped it out the window and it flew, it went off down the river.
Mm-hmm.
Very careless.
Yes, but which causes her dad to then put a sex ban on the entire island, so nobody has sex with his daughter's vulva while it's absent from her body.
Without leave, one might say.
You know what? The most interesting bits in this book are the political stuff.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
sure. I mean, like capital P political, yeah. Than this. So Santine's brother Romanza, who is the one who is queer and has been cast out, they all think that he is indigent, which is the word that she used, that we'd say indigent. So it kept confusing me that it was a different word. I don't know if there's a particular reason for that, but anyway, I kept misreading it when I was reading. But so there's very much a class system on the islands, which comes out as you're reading, and he is very much sympathetic towards you. Not only sympathetic, he has learned to live with them and he understands their ways and the food they eat, and you know, the poverty that they live in, which is partly caused by his father, who's the governor. So that stuff's really interesting, like, and I think is underexplored. What else is interesting? The women, like you said, the sex workers, they've got some really interesting story, like their lives are interesting. Desiree, who was the McKenna before Xavier, she's really interesting. Like, these incredible women. And actually, I wanted more of them, partly because Xavier. So what we haven't mentioned is that Naya, who we went on to marry, has killed herself. It's one of the first things that we find out in the book. And there's some suggestion that the reason she's killed herself is because she knows that he's never loved her and that he's been holding this candle for an ease. And he's just... There's nothing about him that there was nothing about him that I could empathize with, because he was like, he very much felt like a man who needed a good fucking kicking to like sort himself out. Do you know what I mean? I just thought, well, you've been a dick to her. You've just wandered around being like, oh, I'm McKenna and I'm going to do it as I want. And everybody's got to do this and that and the other. And there's nothing redeeming about him. Not even at the end is there anything redeeming about him. So I didn't care enough about him to give a toss about that bit of the story, apart from I wanted to eat one of his meals because they sounded amazing. But other than that, like, he wasn't that interesting to me. Anise is more interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think Anise, out of those sort of main characters, I found Anise the most interesting because, I mean, she has... been married to Tantan, who she finds out right at the beginning of the book has been cheating on her. And the main reason it suggested that he's been cheating on her is because she's had a series of miscarriages and she's been unable to carry a baby to term. And he's gone off and got another woman pregnant, basically. I mean, bastard. You know, awful. And of course, the irony of this is that Anise is a healer. So she heals everyone else, but she can't heal herself. And she, when she sort of has this realization, she finds out that Tantan has been cheating on her and has got this other woman pregnant. She goes off originally to try and she goes to the factory that he works in, and through various other events, finds this group of sex workers. And originally she's kind of thinking, has he been here? But actually she ends up, there's this kind of brilliant sort of camaraderie between them, and that's where she is when Vulvagate occurs.
Oh god.
Which is a definite professional disadvantage when you're a sex worker. And she helps some people reattach, but also when this sort of confrontation, which I won't spoil, happens at the house where all the sex workers are, she sort of steps in to protect them and does everything that she can to protect these women. So I thought she was sort of the most interesting of those characters. But like you, I was sort of more interested in, I was really interested in Santine, who I really wanted more of. I thought she was a really interesting character. I also wanted more of the Fatadik, which is this sort of council of the wise women, as it were, who they sort of have all this knowledge about the cause, about all the magic and the various magical powers that the people of the island itself possesses. And while it has this governor who's actually Santine and Romanza's father, Intizar, who is awful and corrupt and just a dreadful human being generally, He's, you know, normally in charge of the island. Actually, all the power resides with the Fatadik, and the, you know, the literal power almost. And so I was really interested in them, and I wanted a lot more of. I'd read a whole novel about the Fatadik, to be honest.
I'd read a whole novel about Sontine.
And yeah, Ifrit, I would.
Actually, and Romanza. Yeah, I definitely read a novel about them too. The other person I found really interesting, and I can't remember her name, I think she's called Han.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. She's a DJ. So she's the first.
Yeah.
There's lots of feminist stuff. So even though this is meant to be this like magical island, it's still a patriarchy,
mm-hmm.
Despite the fantasy. And she's the first ever female DJ, which is causing some consternation. And she's a great character. But again, it's all the sort of, I've got every cliche in my head now, strong, feisty, etc. Women in it that were way more interesting than following Xavier's story, which, meh. Whatever, not bothered about you. Off you go.
He was definitely not my favourite. I did really like the bit where Romanza is taking him to the Dead Islands and sort of teaching him to not walk on water exactly, but you know, there's this skill that Romanza has picked up of kind of knowing exactly where just under the sea the coral is and where different, you know, the different bits can bear your weight and sort of look to be walking across water. And of course Xavier completely freaks out because he's never done it before and he thinks this is some kind of trick, and you know that he's going to drown and all this sort of stuff. That was a scene that really stuck out to me. If I have any criticism, I do feel like it was a bit too long.
I'm just thinking about your film comment.
Yeah.
Of course it's too long.
And it's not that I don't like long books. I do read long books. I just didn't feel necessarily that one had to be quite as long. Maybe they just cut out some of Xavier. But then I would have wanted it replaced with Sontine. So maybe that's not the way to go about it. I could have done with it being a little bit shorter, but I'm also willing to concede that given how difficult it has been to read recently, this took me like 2 weeks to read, which is unusual. So maybe it was just that I felt like I was spending a really long time reading it because of other factors, but I kind of wanted it to speed up a bit.
See, going back a little bit, I also really liked that bit when Xavier had to walk across water, but I think partly because it just made him look like a dick.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it was, that he was just questioning. And you know, there's a bit where he walks off, isn't he, because he gets pissed off with Romanza, and again, I just felt like he still hadn't learned anything despite the fact that Romanza had shown him all these like possibilities. I read it in a few days, actually. I can't remember whether it was 2 or 3. I think it must have been 3, I think. Mm. So actually, I read it a lot quicker than you did. Did I think it was too long? I'm not sure I did. I actually thought it was lacking depth.
Right.
I thought it was too broad and not deep enough.
It is broad. It definitely is broad. And I think, in some ways, I liked that. In some ways, I liked the fact that this was, it expands across the whole island. It is this one Sky Day in this one very singular kind of, archipelago. This is a word that you don't often say out loud, but you see it written down. In a sense, I like that it was trying to encompass that whole island, and you did see everyone across class lines, you know, from the governors down to the indigent kind of poor. And indeed, you know, you did see the governor get his absolute comeuppance, and rightly so. That was very enjoyable. But yes, I do take your point that it was it. that was possibly at the expense of kind of getting more. Oh, I'm trying to not make a terrible vulva pun. And whatever I say now is going to sound filthy, so I'm just going to crack on, as it were. But no, so for instance, that's a good point, actually. So all the vulvas fall off, but I don't feel like that is terribly resolved. Like, we know what happens. Like, we know, we are told what happens. A lot of people just manage to put them back. As we said, some of them get different ones, and all of that. But I feel like that whole situation, it just sort of was resolved, and that was it. And I feel if my vulva had fallen out and I had to put it back, I don't feel like I'd be over it that quickly.
Yeah, fair point.
I'm sorry to fixate on them, but I don't know. I just didn't feel like that was resolved satisfactorily for me.
Well, it's not the only thing that I didn't feel was satisfactorily resolved, because, spoiler alert, but Santine and Dandu's wedding, which is meant to be the big thing we're building up to, doesn't happen. Well, it does happen, but it doesn't happen in the way that, like, we're expecting to see it happen, which is a bit anticlimactical. And I thought, oh, that's a brave move. I wonder where we're going here. And then the big thing is meant to be Xavier and Anise coming together again, but I didn't care enough about them being together in the first place for that to be emotionally satisfying. I think that's what I was missing. I was missing some sort of emotional connection. It felt like there were loads of things that I'm interested in, like class and gender and politics and how, you know, uprisings might happen, like individuals. So there's an individual called Orange Man who's going around painting things on walls, and we find out actually there's more than one Orange Man, and it's quite interesting when it's revealed who's involved in that, who's obviously trying to, like, destabilize the governor. So there's all this stuff that I felt could have been really, it was really interesting, that I felt was, I don't know, potentially more engaging than what the main sort of thread was. So I thought there was quite a lot that didn't feel resolved to me. Not that everything has to be resolved in a book, but
no, of course not.
It was missing some sort of, like, I don't know, central hook, or it felt like the sort of book. So, you know, the fact that it's like chunky and it's set over one day, it felt like one of those books that you want to feel really emotionally connected to, that you want a proper core. And I thought that's what I was going to get from all the stuff that people had said about it beforehand. I thought that I was going to feel like it was sort of book that you like, the sort of, which is not a criticism, but those sort of, like, meaty novels that you feel like you're really connected to one of the characters and that you really want, like, X thing to happen, and it happens and it's amazing and whatever. And it felt like it was missing that. It felt like it was that sort of book, but without that strand in it.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I mean, I do like a chunky book, as I've said. I mean, I studied Victorian literature. I love Victorian literature. I'm unafraid of a doorstopper. What I love about those big, and there's lots of kind of subversive stuff about Victorian literature that I love as well. That could be a whole other podcast. But I do also, I love a bit of Anthony Trollope. And, you know, what I love
never
about,
do we diverge more, Kirsty.
I know, but what I love about a book like The Way We Live Now, which I think is an extraordinary novel, and it's huge, it's over 1,000 pages, but I loved that book, and it is so, because it is so completely immersive, you get to, you know, it's got a broadcast of characters, it has to for that length of a book. It covers a huge amount of topics. There's love stories, there's political stuff, there's basically cash for questions, there's a dodgy pyramid scheme, there's like literary magazines getting really bitchy with each other. It's basically now, it is the way we live now. You know, infighting, there's scandal, and it's lots, it's very, very broad, but there is that thread of emotional connection. There is that feeling of, you know, if you're asking someone to spend a lot of time with your characters, which you are with a big book, it's got to have that connection. Now, I am not trying to compare Leonie Ross to Anthony Trollope just because they've written long books. Obviously, that's not what I mean. But I do, what I mean to say is, I do love a big, immersive, like those books where you feel like you have to come up for air from them because you're entirely living in that world. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted from this book. And I didn't quite get it. And I wanted to get it. That's what I love about those kind of big chunky traditional books, that entire kind of envelopment in a world.
I'm just nodding away because yes. And I think partly what's interesting about that to me is I love Leonie Ross's short story collection. So I think it's called Come Let Us Sing Anyway. It's a while since I've had it off the shelf, but I've recommended that so many times. I think she's a brilliant short story writer. So it's really interesting to see like a long novel and it missed for me. So yeah.
I do want to read her short stories. I think there's loads to love about her writing. This is definitely not a book of dislikes by any manner of means. It's just not quite what I wanted it to be. And that might be on me. And also, as we've already covered, reading and concentration has been difficult and it took me a long time. I did like a lot of her writing and I would like to read her short stories and I will. Mm-hmm. Speaking of short stories, moving on to our other book, lovely segue. We love a segue. 100 Boyfriends by Brontës Parnell, which is published in the UK by Cypher Press, really interesting small press that's doing loads of really cool kind of queer literature, came out in 2021. This is basically a collection of short pieces that, as I understand it anyway, you've got this central character and this is a look at all of his boyfriends, basically. And actually he says it one point that I call them boyfriends, so this was not always the case, but they were all like pieces of bubble gum you chew hours after the flavor leaves that you accidentally swallow and then supposedly sits in your guts for 7 years. it's his many boyfriends. What did you think?
Again, I didn't love it as much as I wanted to. I read this for ages because it was one of the first things that Cypher Press put out, and I think I've got most of, if not all, that the books that they've published so far, and all the ones I've read, like, I have really enjoyed. And I didn't dislike it. There's bits of it I really liked, but also it felt, I tell you what annoyed me from the beginning was the voice I found really irritating, and I started reading it and it was that sort of millennial disaffected type voice and I was like, oh, Sally Rooney readers are gonna love this. Is where I was at, which is, I like, they should put that on the cover. If you love Sally Rooney, have a bit of 100 Boyfriends from Brontë Parnell. That's that'll put Sally Rooney's BDSM scenes to
you can write about sex a lot better than Sally Rooney.
Having said that, there were some really brilliant, like, I liked how some of these ended, like he's got some really nice sort of end sentence endings, which is something that Roxane Gay is really good at. I think that I found myself comparing it to her short stories. There's this really brilliant one that I won't, this is like in the second set of stories. So there's these hooker boys ones that come up, I think, in each section. So there's like three stories of this. But there's one where there's this whole thing about this thing that happens between these two guys that I won't say what it is. But the ending's this. Some years afterwards, RJ spotted Mike on the train dressed very normal with two other normal gentlemen. RJ proceeded to greet Mike. Mike hugged him, kissed him, stared deep into his eyes and said, "Sorry, it's been so long. What's your name again?" And I just love that sort of dismissal there.
Yeah. I mean, I thought some of it was really funny. There's the one that really made me laugh was the Satanist.
Oh, do you know what? I've got that one open because I think that was my favorite story, but I also knew you'd love it.
Oh, just look, as the ersatz goth, yes. If this was Satan's best sex warrior, it stood to reason why Satanism in general was such a PR nightmare. As both goth and publicist, I felt that.
I just love the description of him when he says, "Before me stood a grown-ass man with surgically implanted fangs, a cape, red contact lenses, and inverted pentagram tattoo on his forehead. The tattoo distracted from his gentle features. He really was a pretty guy, although he fucked in this ugly way."
But then I think my favorite story actually was the one probably with the least sex in it, which is where he's talking about an ex who has struggled with addiction and who he keeps waiting for this him to come back to him. Essentially, he's moved into his house because he's really wealthy. The boyfriend this is really wealthy, and the character's moved into his house. But then the boyfriend sort of fucked off again, and massively relapsed and sort of disappeared. And he says at one point, "The boy who I actually missed is long, long gone, but I cannot sever myself from what remains." And he's just like, he knows this guy is terrible news. He knows this guy's, that the guy he fell in love with is long gone, essentially, but he can't quite let go of the hope that one day he'll come back to him. And I found that an incredibly tender story in amongst a lot of stories with a lot of sex. And actually to have that moment of real kind of heart was, it's sort of what it needed at that point, I think. I think for me, I mean, I think I probably liked it more than you did, but still what I did find all the sex. By the end of it, I was just like, oh God, another sex scene.
I was gonna say, I got to the point when I was like, oh God, another hole.
Well, also that. It was just sort of unrelentingly, it just kept going. It just kept going and going and going. And I don't know what that says about me, but I was just like, oh, I'm quite bored of sex now. But then if that, I don't know if that's maybe sort of the point of the kind of the sort of the same things repeating over and over again, and the kind of the pattern, and you fall into these patterns, and the kind of general sort of unsatisfyingness of the kind of life he's living or what, but
Politically, particularly the epilogue, which I should have loved. So this story about this band on tour, but it literally just becomes, oh, another town, another hole, another town, another hole, another town, another hole. Oh, I ate some shitty food and found another hole. Like that was basically, and I was like, oh my God, is this going to end? I have got to point out in that story though, Stafford is not in the north of England.
No.
Like, what the fuck?
Mean, England's not even that big to get it confused with the North.
Well, it's anything north of Watford Gap, innit?
Yeah, not in London, therefore the North.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Stafford is not in the North.
One of the bits that I like the most, which I think is the same story you're referring to about the addict boyfriend, there's a paragraph near the, like, right near the beginning where they talk about he's got all this stuff. And the narrator says, it wasn't anything a bunch of clear plastic office store boxes wouldn't fix, but it made him nervous nonetheless. He had been to the houses of responsible adults before and didn't really dig it. Adulthood all seemed to be about boxes, mostly boxes, actually. He didn't want to compartmentalize anything, and unlike all the people he knew, he felt he lacked that synapse in the brain that could easily label stuff. Most objects in his head were beyond classification anyways. For example, a picture you didn't want to hide away but didn't want to be confronted with every day. Where the fuck do you file something like that? So there's all bits where I just thought, God, that's brilliant. But they're a bit few and far between.
There's one of the bits I love quite near the beginning, one of the early stories. My mother had explained to me that buildings needed human breath in them to keep them moist and held together. Abandoned buildings are like abandoned people, they die sooner. Just like, oh. Yeah, I mean, it was sort of occasionally brilliant, and then there was quite a lot of forgettable sex.
Only because it just all seemed like it was the same.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm still, like, I'm really glad I read it. And I have to say that I would read him again. Like, this isn't a kind of, well, I'm not going back there. Like, I'd be interested to read more by him. I find him interesting. He's obviously got a really kind of, like, because he's in a band and an artist and a performance artist and a writer, and he seems just like a really interesting dude, basically. So I'm not, like, although I didn't love this book, I'd try. Cypher, I think, have published another of his books, right?
They've published two others. I definitely own Johnny, Would You Love Me If My Dick Were Bigger? But now I'm slightly worried that it's just more. But I guess I'll find out. I think they've also published Since I Lay My Burden Down as well. And if I'm right, I think one of those is a memoir.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd sort of be more interested in the memoir, actually. I would definitely read that.
I think I'd read more if it's not in the same voice. I just found that voice really, well, not all the time irritating, but it was a bit, it's that. I started reading it and I thought, I've heard this voice before. Do you know what I mean? It's one of those, you know, when people go, and this really irritates me because it's not true, but people go, oh, people come out of master's courses and they all write in exactly the same way. it's sort of that, but for a group of writers who probably don't have a master's, but have just, like, got that similar voice. And I just refer to it as a millennial voice, even though I know that's, like, such a wide group of people. But it is that sort of, I don't know, Sally Rooney, Nisha Dolan type. That sort of, like, disaffected, bit bored, bit... And, I mean, I guess it fits the character, but I feel like I aged out of that voice before it even appeared. It happened. It's cool to read instead.
Yeah, I very much know what you mean about the voice, and I am also very much over the... and I technically am a millennial, but I resent it. Because I'm right at the upper edge. I'm elder millennial or zennial or whatever the micro generation is in between. I slightly wish I wasn't millennial. Resentful millennial is what I am. But I am not a particular fan of those writers you've just mentioned. I've read both of them, and I didn't much like either of them. So, no. But memoir, I could be interested in.
Yeah, well, I'll read the other one and let you know. Or maybe I'll read the first two pages and find out whether the voice is similar. No, I didn't dislike it. I'm not recommending it. I think there are people who will love it.
For sure. Absolutely. I can think of loads of people that would really be into it.
For me, it was patchy.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Not to spoil a future episode, but I have also read another book of short stories that we're going to be talking about in a couple of weeks, but I read it before I read these books. I don't know why that happened. Another Cypher Press book called Unreal Sex, which we'll be talking about, I think, in a couple of weeks. I just feel it's quite similar. In terms of, so there's something to look forward to. I feel like there is a bit of a, I feel like there's been a bit of a spate of this sort of writing, of this sort of writing about sex particularly. And that's not a kind of in a prudish, or I don't think we should be writing about sex, blah, 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 blah. But I just feel like a lot of writing about sex ends up being quite similar. At the moment, I feel like there's a lot of kind of, it's never very joyful. It's all quite kind of unrelenting and sort of repetitive. And I got that a little bit from Unreal Sex, which again, we'll talk about in more details, despite that being a different sort of collection in that there's aliens and ghosts and unreal things.
Are you sure?
I am sure. But yeah, I feel like this is a topic we're going to come back to in about 2 weeks' time.
Thanks for that preview of a book I haven't read yet.
Not to put you off. So there were some great stories in it as well, but yeah.
Okay. So before that, next week we are doing...
Next week we are doing Under the Rock by Benjamin Myers. And that's actually, the subtitle of that's different on the hardback than the paperback. And I can't remember what the paperback one is, but the hardback one is The Poetry of a Place. It's not the subtitle of the paperback, but it's called Under the Rock. And the other book is The High House by Jessie Greengrass, which I'm really looking forward to because I loved her first book.
First novel.
Book.
I'm just going to correct you there. I know, because the first one was shortlisted for the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year Awards when I was on the shadow panel, because she was our winner. Her short story collection was our winner. And then Max Porter won the overall prize.
There you go. I did not realise she'd written short stories before. I just knew the novel. Sight.
Sight's very good. Yeah. Good stuff. In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. I am not going to wang on about social media anymore because social media is
dead. What's the point?
We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.